side number one of tape number two, an interview with Betty and Bud Gillies at their home in Rancho Santa Fe, California. It's Wednesday, the 2nd of November, 1977, and it is 6:26 p.m. And we're talking about Amelia and Grover and Bud and Betty going to a New York play. And as I understand it, the play was possibly, the name was Flying High, starring Bert Lahr. And Bert, what was this story Bert told that, it was kind of a joke to set up the scene?
He was being given a medical examination for his pilot's license, and the doctor handed him a beaker to get a specimen in, and Bert Lahr made out like he didn't know what he was supposed to do, and ended up taking a flask out of his hip pocket and pouring some whiskey into this beaker and giving it back to the doctor. And the rest of the audience was rolling in the aisles with laughter at Bert Lahr because he really made a real funny scene of this. But Amelia didn't laugh at all.
She didn't feel that was quite proper for
right.
stage
right.
performance. I see. Well, now she's well known for not liking off-court. Did you ever see her get angry?
No.
There's a funny pattern of things here. Amelia's had been working up in Boston, the Settlement House, until she made the Atlantic flight in 1928. And she was dating a Boston boy and had been. He was an electrical engineer and had been for many years. And as close as I can tell, from the day she left on that trip, she never saw him again. Did she ever speak of a boyfriend
no,
in Boston?
No, I never knew she'd... had that kind of a strong relationship with
yeah,
somebody
very
before.
Close relationship, and it lasted.
My feeling is that Amelia had the same type of interest in aviation that I had. I had decided that not to love any women, to only love aviation, and I that was my interest. And I felt she had somewhat the same type of all-encompassing interest in just the aviation world.
Betty, were you aware that when Amelia lived in Los Angeles and later in Boston, that she was dating one fellow all the time and had had a very strong relationship with him for a number of years? But as far as I can determine, from the time she made the flight across the Atlantic in 1928, she never laid eyes on him again. Did she ever speak to you about him at all? Never mentioned him?
No, I don't remember that we ever had personal conversations. Eldon, we talked, airplanes talked, 99ers talked generally, but I don't remember ever getting into a personal type of conversation, either my talking to her or her talking to me about personal things.
Okay. Well, now, about this time, you and some of the other prominent women pilots thought that it would be a very good idea, or actually before this time, that you decided to form a woman's flying pilots organization? Where did that idea come from, as you remember? How did you first learn about it?
Well, there's lots of discussion on that, and I just don't really know. I just was one of those people that happened to get to be at the right place at the right time when they had a meeting. The 99s have done some research on how it got started, who were the people that started it. But there's a lot of discussion as to whether some of the group that had been in the air races out west, Cleveland, had decided there was going to be a club, or whether it was really started through the group of women at Curtis Wright. I got my contact and information on the first meeting came through my job there at Curtis Wright.
A
girl named Helen Weber was public relations for Curtis Wright, in their main office in New York. And she and another woman named Clara Trenchman, wasn't it? Clara Trenchman, T-R-E-N-C-H-M-A-N, and Helen Weber put it together. In other words, they got the letters out and they made the contacts.
Helen Weber was not a pilot.
Neither of them were pilots. They were employees there, too. And the meeting was called at Valley Stream, and I just happened to be convenient. I was working there, and I happened to be at the right place at the right time to become a charter member.
You were not involved in organizing the meeting.
I was not the least bit involved in organizing it.
When was this first meeting held?
1929, but the dates I should know, but that's all a matter of record somewhere.
Well, the reason
I have a little blue book.
Because I want to know, were you out 1929, you were still working on your commercial, though in the early part you were still working on your private.
Yeah. Oh,
where
in my aeronautical library here.
I'll pull this out.
Okay, on November 2nd, 1929, a day described meteorologically as only so-so, 26 licensed women pilots gathered in a hangar at Curtis Field, Valley Stream, Long Island, competing with the whir of spinning motors, the banging of hammers, and the smell of paint sprays. They emerged 2 hours later with tea and chocolate leaves served from a mechanic's bench as the foundation of the 99 Club, which will celebrate its 12th eventful year in aviation on November 2nd, 1941. Now, you attended that meeting. Mm-hmm. And I have a photograph said it was a meeting of the people taken. Mm-hmm, all sitting out there. Was that taken that day?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Then on November 2nd, 1929, you were very close to getting your limited commercial license. I thought you said that you got it on December 1st. So, hey, you know something? Oh, my goodness. The next paragraph here just floors me. The person mainly responsible for this historic gathering was Clara Trenchman Studer, a non-flyer.
The letters we have gotten from her are unbelievable.
Well, she's been batty for quite a few years. She's batty, but she wasn't then. That was a long time ago.
I interviewed her at great length in New York and tried to help her and whatnot. And
she's been batty now for a long time. But she, at that time, she was working for Curtis Wright. But I said Clara Trinkman. And that's why I don't even like to go on record what I think. When I was president, you read the girls that wrote this, put this together for me, because there was so much argument. And Louise Thaden's one of them. Is Thaden there who put it together?
Well, it said Clara rounded up four of them.
No, the who wrote the thing.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Book. Let me see. Yeah, over here. The background of the 99 was... This background, the 99s, was written by Fay Wells. 4021 is sponsored by a committee appointed by the President, Fay Hannah Gillies. The committee consisted of the following charter members: Louise Thaden, Margaret Cooper, and Ruth Nichols. In commemoration of the 15th anniversary, we present this brochure, a short outline of the founding of the 99s, its activities and accomplishments for its members, and so forth. So that was the committee that's what they said. They said it started. And I know that my communication to go to that meeting came through Clara Trenchman Studer and Helen Weber, who were at Curtis. Now, then there's the group that say that they decided they were going to do this out at Cleveland, and But, no, you couldn't interview Clara intelligently for the past 20 years.
You know, I'm very, very sorry. You'll have to excuse my... I keep getting Gillies mixed up with Gillis. And
Faye.
Yes. But I have to stop and see her next time you're anywhere near Washington.
Oh, wonderful.
But she's asked me to come and visit her.
She really would be terrifically helpful to you in this.
All right. So you were at Valley Stream working very hard on getting your commercial license. In fact, within a few, just a couple, 3 weeks after that, you got your limited commercial. And like you say, you received the information, you happened to be there, and it's convenient for you to go, but you didn't have any driving force in organizing the thing or whatnot. That picture was taken that day, famous one. That, all right. Now, what do you remember firsthand or from your knowledge about how you felt about the 99s, how you felt about what you could do in aviation, and how you and Faye and Ruth and all the other peoples who did so much for women in early aviation, how did you see yourself and how did you see these other people in what you were trying to do it and how you were trying to do it?
I don't know. We didn't look. You sound like a modern psychologist asking questions, because I don't think we thought about those things. We just did. We lived each day for the day, and we did what we could, and then I don't recall going into a great analysis about what I was doing for or who else was doing for it. I don't remember.
You just
went ahead and did it and had fun. You know, we weren't introverted like this generation is now, thinking, why am I here? You know, who am I? This kind of business. There wasn't any of that. We just did it. We just felt sort of privileged to be able to do it, I guess. I mean, I certainly felt privileged.
How much static did you get from certain members of the opposite sex?
None? I have never had any static from the opposite sex. Never.
Over flying at all?
Never.
Never been chauvinistically attacked? Or
not that I was conscious of. Now, it may be that transition was held up when we're in the ferry command by somebody who was chauvinistic, but I don't know for sure that was it, or the airplane may have been out, or the airplane may have been off, or there may have been some other good reason, or there may be a priority on some other pilot getting transition time or something. How do you know?
What, did you have any aimed long-range goals in flying?
No, catch my husband and then have a good time, and then you get interested in doing, I think you should understand what I'm talking about.
I don't. I want you to say it.
I can't say it. No, I don't think so. I think that I never had a desire to break any records. I don't know why. It didn't interest me to break records. I loved little competitions, little contests that we had in those days, like balloon bursting and little treasure hunts and cross-country races and around from...
Aviation busting.
We'd go up and let balloons out, and then go up and turn around, and do a wing over, and come back and bust it with your propeller. It's quite a neat trick. Oftentimes the darn balloon go right through the prop. But you could get your airplane into quite fascinating positions, couldn't you?
The balloon bursting was the balloon was released from the ground.
The balloon was the toilet paper was.
The toilet paper
was released.
Paper
from the
scraping
air.
Was from with the air.
Yeah, the balloons were laced in the ground, and they'd rise, and then you'd go out, and you'd go at them, and then they'd go through your prop, and then you'd do a wing over and come back and try to get them over here, and so forth, and then the paper scraping.
With the balloon and releaser down here, at some point you would wiggle your wings, and they'd start a stopwatch and release the balloon at the same time, and they'd take the time until you broke the balloon. If you were good, you hit it head on and busted it right the first pass, but if not, as Betty said, you had to come around and try to catch it as it was going up.
And of course, the closer it is to the ground, the more dangerous it is to be doing wild maneuvers.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Less room to recover.
Oh, well, we didn't think about anything being dangerous in those days. And we didn't have any HUD, no health department or Department of Health, Education, and Welfare.
I could
we could do a lot of things with airplanes that you couldn't do now. But
something burning.
The messy one.
I hope it's a nice potato. I would feel so honored.
The messy one was when we go up and take a roll of toilet paper and throw it out the airplane, and it would unroll.
It would automatically unroll.
Yeah, it would automatically string down. Then you had to try to cut it three times.
Three times is it? I could see it, what they could call an advanced game of balloon busting, where two guys go out and see who's the first one to get it. That could get a bit tricky.
That was the kind of thing we used to call a Mexican stunning contest. The man that came in second won.
I see. That was a joke of that time. The Mexican stunning man who came in second won. Very good. She mentioned another type of contest, the paper cutting. What do you call that? Do you have a name for that besides paper cutting?
Balloon bursting, spot landing.
Spot landing.
And we had, I'm looking at some of these movies that Grover had there with a race that started with running to get out in the airplane, go around a circuit, and come back in, and there was a whole collection of potatoes, and the passenger got out and ran over, got this pile of potatoes, and threw them into a bucket at the other end, and they counted the number of potatoes that went in the bucket, and then they had to go and do something else. Treasure hunts was an interesting
thing.
How would
a treasure hunt work?
Well, give you a poem, a little piece of poetry that would have a clue as to where you might go to find the next clue, and you'd have to go and land in the field inside a racetrack and find a clue tacked up on the pole in the racetrack, and that'll tell you where to go for the next one if you
like. It's like a scavenger hunter, treasure hunter, I see.
Hey, tell me about the landing over a barrier. That was the one that really took the toll.
Yeah.
How did that work?
Well, they had a barrier. A
10-foot string. Piece of rope stretched on 10 feet off the ground, and you had to see who could land closest to over the barrier.
Well, touch down over the top of the barrier. In other words, you clear the barrier, and where you touch that distance.
Bang.
Much of a mushed attitude as you can get.
You ought to have been pretty good at that after being on a carrier.
I was embarrassed yesterday to have to admit that I was the one that collapsed the gear on the Robin in the movie.
All right, well now, did Amelia ever remember her ever participating in any of these things? Because
I don't think so.
I don't recall her participating in this.
She had grander plans. I think she was introspective, and I think she did have a mission, and I think she had long-range plans.
No, I think so too. This was club activity, fun activity, You could do things like that in those days. And I think that it's too bad you can't now, because it was a different kind of flying. It was sport flying, really. It was just great.
Well, now, we have time now. Amelia married George Palmer Putnam in February 1931 now. And was it 32?
31, I think.
Anyway. GP and her are married now, and of course Amelia moves to Rye now. And do you remember? Did this come as a surprise or anything, or mm-hmm. Do you remember it all?
I just remember it happened.
Did you read about announcement in the paper, or were you invited over to the wedding, or
we didn't go to the wedding. I don't know that.
Do you remember if you were invited or not?
I don't even remember that. Do you?
I don't remember anything about the wedding.
Mm-mm.
You just all of a sudden knew that
Amelia and GP were married.
Did you have a big wedding?
No. Mm-hmm. I know all of you.
I don't even know where they were married.
They were married in Connecticut. I can't remember.
Connecticut?
That's right. Or Long Island? Anyway, they were in Connecticut. I can't remember exactly. I don't trust my memory. Hey, on the tape,
no.
Paying attention to what I just said.
On
other tapes. As a matter of public record, too. You must have saw her in GP then quite a bit after that, though.
We did.
How did that come about?
Just various aviation things, with gatherings that you'd go to, or people would come to the country to entertain them. I've forgotten all the people, but there were numerous times, and people like Jim and Amy Mollison and Nancy Walton, Nancy Bird Walton came over and stayed with us in 35. First, I think it was about 35 that she came there. People like that that would come into the ground.
Well,
roller skating parties we had at Roosevelt Field.
Roller skating party, yeah.
No, there were just
various
events.
Roller skates, don't you?
We'd clear out a hangar.
I
don't
know where it was taken, though. I could never figure out where it was taken.
Don't you know that story of that one?
I have the
photograph. That was taken in a hangar at Roosevelt Field. She was.
You see that picture with Betty and Amelia and.
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of girls there.
No, just four of us.
Well, I can just remember
Caleb.
Girls on roller skates and.
Give the name.
Give the names.
L.B. Caleb, Francis Marsalis, Amelia, and me.
And you were skating in the hangar?
These pictures were taken, advanced publicity for a roller skating party. We were the 99s, the New York chapter was putting on to raise funds for an airplane. And the pictures were taken the day before the big event, and they're taken out on the apron. One of them has the FAA inspector, not Dome Harwood, it was the other one. Who was the other FAA?
Sandy Willis,
there, giving us a start signal and so forth. I have them in the other room, but you must have those in your file.
I have the photographs, but I've been asked, I got them from Northrop.
Ruth Wagner?
Yeah.
Ruth Wagner?
No.
Eleanor Wagner?
No. At the Aviation Museum at Northrop University.
No.
Okay. Anyway, he has all these pictures, but he doesn't know what they are. I mean, he can identify them in the air, but he doesn't identify anybody else. And he asked me.
Who has them?
You know in the aviation hall that they started up there at Northrop University, American Hall of Aviation, I think they call it. Mm-hmm. He has pictures, but he doesn't know all the names of the people, so now we'll be able to tell him.
Yeah, well, I can
probably do much better than that. The thing to do is to get a set of pictures and have you identify the people on the form. Hey, Hatfield.
Hatfield, right, Mr. Hatfield. He's ahead of it, and
I thought Eleanor Wagner was working very closely with him.
She
certainly ought to know. That
I just don't have it over. All my contacts have been directly with him.
Oh, about a year ago, I got a bunch of cards with prominent women's pictures on them, and they're printed by two ladies. Women, I don't know whether the ladies never met them, who have their business up in the Middle West. And they sent me a card of this picture of Amelia and Francis and Elvie and me. And they had, they live there in Indiana, is where they work, and they had gone to Esther Poole, who was a WASP in my squadron and is State Director of Aviation in Indiana, to find out who these were. But they recognized Amelia, but they didn't know who the other girls were. So they went to Esther to ask her, and so she referred them to me. So in comes this card, about so big, with his picture on it. So, well, I didn't like the idea at all, really, of having the picture on the card, but as long as they were making them, I thought it would be better if I wrote and told them who the people were, because it would be better than having them make up a line of stuff. So I did, and the last thing I heard was that they were going to be released at the NOW convention last summer. Oh, dear. Of all the organizations in the world. So I haven't seen them. Maybe they never did print them. But anyway, that picture on roller skates was the one. So if you see it on a card in some, you know, one of these funny-looking stores that have picture postcards of old antique ones, and they had them, famous people.
Okay, well, Amelia really wasn't very active in the 99. She was really quite busy with too many other things.
She was very busy.
Wasn't she preparing for her solo flight across the Atlantic?
Well, I was going to say, now, when did you first hear that Amelia was going to make the solo flight across?
She kept that very, very quiet. Very quiet. Now, I couldn't tell you when I first heard it.
Did you know much before that she did it?
She kept it very quiet.
Did you see her at all?
Oh, it's been too long for me to remember. Amelia had some meetings, 99 meetings at her home. And as Bud said, when visiting firemen came, or there was a aviation meeting, NAA or some aviation, New York aviation organization or something, we'd meet, our paths would cross, we'll say, at aviation events. Socially, I didn't see her.
She didn't date Grover much after 1930. You know, she became extremely busy.
Yeah, of course she did.
I'm going to relate a whole bunch of things.
Louise Sladen took over the 99s in the beginning and was the chairman, more or less, and Amelia was elected president. That book gives you the dates that happened.
Yeah, I see that.
Mm-hmm. When they changed. I can't remember those details. That's why we had the little book written way back our 12th anniversary, because at that point people didn't. There was an argument about how to start it and who did start it. And I really see Faye Gillis Wells was also connected there with Curtis. And Faye is a very sharp person. Oh, I wish she'd write a book. God. Anyway, this was her version, and Louise approved it. So I felt that it's probably the right version.
Okay. Well, then actually, you really didn't see you didn't see Amelia really on any business. You just saw whenever it was an aviation-oriented activity or be invited to some activity that was happening out at Rye or a club or things like this.
We'd go out to see take off in the Bendix or something like that.
You had quite a bit of contact through the years, but it wasn't... it was more aviation-oriented than it was socially-oriented.
That's right, very much.
What did you think of her husband?
I never thought.
What kind of an impression did he make?
Well, he's a good-looking guy. I never thought much of him one way or another. It's funny. I just take people without really doing too much thinking.
Well, what did you think of GP?
Well, he was very,
very attractive,
pleasant person to know socially, and go on these parties or picnics or dinner at their house. I never was particularly impressed with his mental capabilities. I didn't think he was a particularly sharp, smart person. But I don't think I've ever really appreciated publicity-minded, public relations-type people. And that's more what he was than
Did he give you the impression that he was wealthy?
Oh, yes.
Did you think
he was wealthy? Well, he, yeah, yes.
I would have classed him as well off, yeah.
He never knew where his next meal was going to come from. Mm-hmm.
Good bluffer.
Right.
He really played a game. After Dorothy Binney's the one that had all the money, and when she divorced him, boy, she pulled the rug right out from underneath him. As you well know, he had to sell the publishing company and everything. He had to sell it. They just took it away from him. Mm-hmm. And did you ever know where the money came from? Interesting little sidelight. If you ever looked at a packet of Crayolas, you know, the little yellow Crayola box, mm-hmm. You look on it, it says Binney and Smith. Well, she's the Binney of Binney and Smith.
It's her father.
Yeah.
Her father. And when Dorothy divorced him, she financially pulled everything right out of her. And he had the House of Rye. And how much would you estimate that home was worth?
In those
days. In any way you can think of it. How big a house was it?
I would say it was probably about 80,000.
I wouldn't have.
I was thinking it compared to our house, which is a house we built, and the property was about that much. And it's about the same type of a house.
I don't think I don't think I ever looked at it as a.
Was it as big a home as this?
No, it was taller and not as much square footage on one floor as here. I wouldn't. No, it was a medium-sized house.
It wasn't a big palatial home.
It wasn't a great big mansion, no.
Of course, when it burned, it went, a lot of stuff went with it.
I didn't know it burned.
Yeah, it burned up in 1935.
Hmm. Well, then your contact after her solo flight across the Atlantic, did you have much contact with her anymore after that?
Only in aviation, in paths crossing, or in 99, things like that.
Did you notice any change in her manner or her ways or anything about her after she became that famous?
Mm-hmm. No, I didn't think mm-hmm. so.
Because mm-hmm. she did become the foremost woman pilot in the world at that mm-hmm. time.
No, I didn't see any change. She was, she was the same Amelia.
I saw her when her airplane was being rebuilt. I talked to her then, and my recollection is she was just the same kind of a person she'd always been.
Well, in 1935 or 34, they moved out to the West Coast. And as you remember, she made the flight across from Hawaii to Oakland, mm-hmm. and that was in February 35, or
January 35.
And they were living here on the West Coast. This is when Amelia became acquainted with Paul, and they eventually built a home at Valley Spring mm-hmm. Lane.
Valley Spring Lane.
Have you ever been over that house?
No.
It's still there. It's quite an interesting home. But did you ever see them after the Hawaii flight? Did you ever see Amelia after that when she was on the West Coast? Now, you mentioned the plane being rebuilt. I wondered if you were talking about the Lecter being rebuilt in 37.
That's what I'm talking about.
Did you see her in New York when she came mm-hmm. back on a trip?
I'm sure it was in New York, although I...
Did you ever make any comment about how that happened to you?
No, I remember talking to her about the equipment in the airplane and the concern she had with the weight and what she could leave out of it. And, in my recollection is... of talking to her about leaving out the 550 kilocycle transmitter that would have was necessary for the Coast Guard to give her D.F. Steers. And being concerned that she was going to leave that out, because if I recall correctly, the equipment on the Coast Guard ship that she was to rendezvous with would only receive 550 kilocycles and then would give her a steer.
That's correct. And
if I recall correctly, my advice to her was not to leave it out, but it was a heavy piece of equipment. It took a lot of power. And to best of my knowledge, she did leave it out.
You said it was removed at Miami.
Yeah, Miami.
You know, he might be able to answer a question for you. If you talk equipment with her, do you know what kind of radio she actually had when she went on the round-the-world trip?
What make? No, I sure don't.
You don't recall ever seeing them or talking to her about them at all?
Not enough.
Did you know Harry Manning? Did you know Harry Manning, Captain Manning?
No, I didn't know him.
You knew
him? Matter of fact, I know I met him, but I've never had any dealings with him.
Did you saw her then in New York, just as happened across, or? How did you happen to see her in New York when she was...
I wouldn't have the slightest idea.
Just ran into her.
What kind of affair it was that brought us together.
But you didn't have any social contact really after 1932 then, as far as them inviting over for dinner or going out to play with you or anything like that for MGP. Did you ever go out with her and GP, do you remember? Just the four of you?
Well, yes, we had, I know we had dinner at their house a couple of times, and I know I can recall very clearly a picnic, probably a Saturday picnic lunch that we went to their house and then went off somewhere nearby there in the woods and had a picnic lunch. Things like that.
So she did maintain contact with you then on a social basis even after she married GP.
Oh yes. We were good friends, all of us.
They had aviation in common.
Yeah.
But she didn't consult you about the Vega or the trip across the North Atlantic.
No.
Well, now Bert Balchin worked with her quite a bit on that. Did you know Bert?
No, again, I've met him, but I sure don't know him. I've met him numerous times over a long period of years.
Well, now, he was working across the bay over to, I mean, across the Hudson over Peterborough, I guess. I don't know who he was working for. Was he working for Fokker? I think he was.
That could be. That's where the Fokker factory was.
I think he was working for Fokker. And then they... But you didn't know anything about the preparations of the Vega for the transatlantic flight.
No.
Did you happen to go to any one of the ticker tape parades either in 28 or in 32 when Amelia came back?
No, I doubt if we did. Because in 28, I'm sure we didn't. Because I didn't. No, 28. Actually, I was out here.
That's right. You weren't back yet. You were alone. In 32, do you remember the reception that was given to you when she came into New York City? You didn't.
I don't recall it.
You didn't attend. You didn't go down here, Jimmy Walker, and make a speech. You know?
No, I don't. I don't think I was.
Might not have been
there. No.
Well, you felt that you saw Amelia in New York in 37 while her airplane was being repaired. You know, she did so many things that I have some of the things I'm not sure that Betty is aware of, even that I wanted to tell her about them, but she's gotten busy.
I'll shut this off for the moment. I'll ask you about that now, because this is very interesting. I've interviewed at great length, I can't remember his name, but Mr. Aviation, star of the Aviation Club in Washington, D.C. there, and he was president of Northeast and everything until they sold out to Delta. He Eugene Vidal, Pat Collins, and Amelia started Boston and Maine Airways. They put in $2,500 a piece, and with the $10,000 they got. Did you know Eugene Vidal?
I knew him, but not well, yes.
I see. Were you aware that he and Amelia were very good friends?
Not particularly. I wouldn't have known, but I was not surprised, because, again, they were all part of the aviation world at that time.
Did you know Sam? He was the president of Northeast Airlines.
I know who you mean, but I was not particularly involved through that era with the air transport.
Did you know Pat Collins at all?
No.
He must have been a fantastic guy. Yeah. He had 9,000 hours in 1932. That's unheard of. Had you ever heard of such a thing? That much flying time in 1932? Fantastic. Well, what was Amelia's reputation as far as you were concerned, and what you'd heard around the grapevine as a pilot? You're a test pilot. Pilots talk about pilots. Was there anything that you had to do? What do you know about her ability as a pilot, as a mechanic?
I considered her to be a very capable pilot. She certainly gave me that feeling the way she flew the Lockheed Electra around the country.
Did you ever fly with her in an airplane?
No, but I flew her Electra. She let me fly it.
Where was that at and when?
Well, at the Aviation Country Club, Long Island, which was a dinky
little...
What field
was that at, Aviation Country Club?
It was a little grass field at Hicksville, New York.
At Hicksville, New York. Was this a club like the QBs or something like that?
No. This was a country club with hangars and flight instruction and restaurant and tennis court and swimming pool
But aviation,
three bedrooms where people could stay overnight, and it was right alongside the Motor Parkway, which was a toll road that existed back in those days, that you could start at almost in at Flushing and drive all the way out Long Island. It was the Long Island Motor Parkway. It was right alongside of that. We had an area to pull off the parkway and park and step over the fence.
And so she flew. You must have had a pretty good length of strip. You must have at least 2,000 feet then to bring the light.
Well, it was probably 2,500 feet long and about 1,200 feet north and south.
So you could kind of edge into a crosswind.
Yeah, yeah.
And she brought the Electra into the...
Yeah.
That must have been in 1936, then. That must have been either February or January of 37, or must have been before the air race in 36.
One time I went over to Teterboro and picked up the airplane for her and brought it over to the club for her.
The Electra?
Yeah. No, not the Electra.
Vega.
I didn't mean the Electra.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I didn't mean the Electra.
Okay, the Vega.
The Vega, yeah.
I see. Oh, I see.
Yeah,
okay.
The Vega. It was earlier than 36. You were confusing me when I was confusing things by saying the Electra.
Yeah, no, I understand. Okay, and you flew the Vega, the one that's in the Smithsonian right now. No, wait a minute. She had two Vegas. The one she flew across the North Atlantic was 9-5 Yankee.
My recollection is this one had a right engine in it.
I don't know.
I don't know that either.
But the one in the Smithsonian is the one she flew across the North Atlantic. Uh-huh. But that's a different airplane than the one she flew from Hawaii to Oakland.
she got another. The one she flew across the North Atlantic was rather an old Vega, and then she, the fact now she
listen,
got her a new one.
The one I flew was a rather old one.
Okay.
Can I ask
you let's see, the side of the tape spot. Just keep talking. It's fun. Well, tell me more about now. You you worked for Loaning. How long?
Until he retired from active aviation aircraft manufacturing at the end of 1933. We closed up and liquidated the plant, which was at Hangar 17 at the old Curtis Field, which had become part of a combined Roosevelt Field. And then I moved over to Grumman Aircraft on January 1st of 1934 and spent the next 11 years with Grumman, where I had charge of all the flight test activity and Navy liaison and became vice president and director of the company.
Now, you did you ever get any more formal training after your graduation from MIT?
No.
Okay.
No.
So you were actually had your Bachelor of Science degree in Mechanical Engineering, and that was the end of your formal.